listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I can't complain. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Catherine Devaney, a wearer of many hats. Some of them are, like, you're a neuroscientist, and you studied the effects of meditation on the brain. In fact, you're doing an interesting study now that we talked about last time, mm-hmm. where you're studying these kind of levels of meditative attainment or whatever called jhanas and the effect on mm-hmm. the brain. You're conversant in the effect of psychedelics on the brain. You have possibly some firsthand experience with that at some point in your life, as I recall.
True.
But you're also on the applied end of things, right? You co-founded this place in Berkeley called the Alembic, where mm-hmm. meditation is taught and people's spiritual growth is guided and so on. So, like, when somebody asks you, like at a party or something, just what do you do? And you just feel you have to be super concise. Or like if you had a business card, if people still had business cards, like what's the one-line takeaway here?
Yeah, it's a bit challenging to, someone once told me that I was impossible to pigeonhole, and that is true. So a lot of what I say depends on the situation I'm in. Mm. When I was in college, if I met people at a party and they asked what I was studying, and mm-hmm. I wanted to keep talking to them, I would say psychology. And if I wanted to stop talking to them, I would say neuroscience, and they would just walk away.
And that hasn't changed over the years. I thought neuroscience had gotten cooler, no?
I think it has gotten cooler now. Mm-hmm. So for now, what I usually say is something around the cluster of neuroscience, meditation, and psychedelics. And if I need to expand on that a little bit, I say I do neuroscience research on meditation, and I also am the co-founder and executive director of a wacky meditation center called the Alembic.
Okay. Wacky is a good word. I haven't heard that applied to a meditation center before. So last time I think we kind of maybe started at the deep end. The work you're doing on the jhanas and so on. And I want to cover that. I want to get back into that this time and get into the psychedelics and so on. And I want to discuss the concept of enlightenment. But I also want to cover the other end of the spectrum. Like, I think a common situation for people these days. I mean, like 50 years ago in America, the thing to do in terms of teaching about meditation was tell people like what it is, how to start. I think now you have a lot of people who have done some of it, but have kind of like fallen off the wagon and they need to get back on it. And I think COVID, in my own case, because I didn't go to any meditation retreats during COVID, you know, the practice got a little weak. So I also want to talk about that. And I want to talk about the kind of spiritual scene in Silicon Valley, which you're somewhat in contact with by virtue of being in Berkeley, right? Stop me when I've listed too many things, okay?
This sounds like we've got 3 hours of conversation right here.
Well, then I'll stop. Wait, was there something else I was going to say? I guess, no, that's plenty. At some point, I will introduce artificial intelligence into the conversation, and there are commenters who will not like that. They think I talk about that too much, but I'm going to hold off on that. On the menu, if you were going to select from the menu of things I've just provided, what would you want to talk about first?
Well, let's think a little bit about why people are coming to meditation now and maybe what happened during COVID and how we're still seeing the implication, like the after effects of that. That'd be a fun place to start. So I think the thing you bring up is really interesting, where during COVID, a lot of people who'd been meditating for a long time felt the impact on their practice because retreats stopped. And as anyone who's been meditating for a while knows, a lot of the real deep end of meditation practice happens on retreat. But something else that's very interesting happened, where a lot of people who had never meditated before were starting to hear, you know, it was an incredibly stressful time for mm-hmm. everyone, mm-hmm. and people were stuck at home. So a lot of new people at the beginner level came into the practice. So emerging from COVID, we have this really interesting phenomenon that's happened over the last couple of years, where there are a lot more people, I think, than pre-COVID who have what you might call like a casual or beginner level meditation practice, where they've been, say, they downloaded an app during COVID and they've been doing 10 minutes a day and then they want to level up their practice. And a lot of the deeper practitioners, people who had a lot of practice momentum going into COVID, I think, and I'm curious how this was for you, got to see the benefits of practice. Like I noticed at the beginning of COVID when I was talking with my family and when I was talking with my friends who didn't meditate, there was a level of, let's just say equanimity that was available to me that I was able to share with others, which I think is really a fruit of the practice.
Okay. So, I mean, in answer to your question, I wouldn't say I handled the challenge particularly well. I mean, I had gotten in this habit of using kind of an every 2 years or so meditation retreat to recharge my practice. Because the common thing is you go to a meditation retreat, by the end of it, you feel you've been transformed. These are like, for me, 1 week, 9 days, sometimes 2 week retreats. And you practice every day to maintain whatever you can maintain, but inevitably it's hard to hang on to the state of consciousness you had at the end or at maybe the best point of the retreat for you. So I had become kind of dependent on the recharge and I was just about due for a recharge when COVID hit and the meditation centers, you know, pretty much closed, certainly the one I had been going to. You know, I kept meditating, I guess, but it wasn't, but my practice suffered, I would say, the quality of the practice. And for a while, I probably fell off the wagon entirely. There were probably months where I just didn't meditate, but I'm meditating again. And I have a retreat scheduled for this spring and we hope that that will work wonders. Meanwhile, I've resorted to some pretty desperate measures to keep myself meditating. Maybe I'll share one of those later. It's pretty embarrassing. Ooh. I don't want to start off with it. It's really pathetic. But
I can't wait to hear.
It's sad. So that's my situation. What do you? Here's the thing. Like the question, what you would say to somebody who's just at home trying to restart their practice, how much does that have in common with what you would tell someone who has never practiced, right? I have some ideas about that, but what are those totally separate questions to you?
Well, I think there's a key thing here, which is motivation to practice. And that motivation is going to be different for someone who has experienced some of the benefits of practice versus someone who's just starting out. So someone who's just starting a practice, they are probably curious about several different things. They're motivated by several different factors. And I see a lot of that now with people just starting a practice now. When I started, a lot of people were practicing for enlightenment. Like the idea was enlightenment's real. I can do it. I'm going to start this practice and I'm going to get enlightened. And then there was another cluster of people who were really, really suffering and wanted to suffer less. People starting practice now have often heard about optimizing themselves or optimizing their productivity or...
That's a big Silicon Valley thing, right?
Exactly. So there's like the optimizers who often ask me like, okay, what's the minimum amount of minutes I could do per day to get all the benefits? We don't know. And then there are also, there's still that cluster of people who are looking for a more meaningful life or less suffering or better relationships and have an idea that meditation is the way to do that. But the motivation before you start practicing is based on kind of hearsay or a concept, like a concept of what meditation is going to do. And
is that a bad thing?
No, it may be a really good thing. And you have in the Pali Canon, there's that sutta
I'm only clarifying this because for some reason, the movie Pollyanna just came to my attention and I even watched the trailer for it. So to be clear, it's not P-O-L-L-Y, it's P-A-L-I. That's one of the two main languages in which the Buddhist canon is found. It is Theravadan Buddhists would say that it's the language that the Buddha spoke. Maybe others would say that. But anyway, much of the canon is in Pali and the other language is Sanskrit.
Yeah. So these are the original recorded teachings of the Buddha. And of course, they weren't recorded during his lifetime. It was like hundreds of years later. But this is like the earliest Buddhist record that we have. And there's one sutta in there, in which the Buddha says, if you spent 100 years getting stabbed by 100 spears every hour, it's something like, I'm paraphrasing, but then, and then at the end of those 100 years, after you'd been stabbed 100 times every day, you got enlightened, that would be a life well lived, and all the pain of those 100 spears would be
so
would
far
be worth
I'm sticking
it.
To the plan. All that, right? All that I need to do is the enlightenment part, but it's working well.
And then there's, of course, that famous Shinzen Young quote where he says, if he could have all of the pleasures of the world, if he could be like a literal rock star with infinite money and infinite worldly possessions for the rest of his life, or he could live one more day in the consciousness that he's in, having practiced so much, and then die, he would choose the one day. So there are these things that are out there that are very conceptually motivating, but if you haven't experienced some of this stuff, you would be wise to be skeptical about that. And so people who are just beginning, I think the key is to start seeing what the practice is like for yourself in your own life. And for people who've already had a practice, presumably they dropped it for the same reason people drop, say, being on a diet or exercising or there's myriad other reasons. Sometimes you have a big opening in your practice and it makes sense to back off a little bit and let that integrate. So there's all sorts of reasons why.
Wait, can you elaborate when you say you have a big opening? What does that mean when you have a big opening and you back off? And
so say you have...
You have like a powerful experience?
Or like a deep insight. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so there are times where it's wise to back off, and then there are times where it's wise to go deeper. But with both groups of people, I think there are some like behavioral things that are common between the two. And one is that there's nothing wrong with doing low dose practice. Like there's that saying, the optimal amount of practice is the amount that you can do. And so for people who are just starting, or even for people who are restarting, do 5 minutes a day, do 7 minutes a day, do 10 seconds right now. Whatever the amount is that you're going to do is the right amount. It's better to do 3.5 minutes a day than pretend you're doing an hour a day, but actually doing zero.
Right. And you know, there's one other tip that somebody gave me once that I think is pretty good. If you're planning to commit to a daily practice, and let's say it's 30 minutes, and some days you just say, I just can't do it for whatever reason. Okay. Mm-hmm. But you still have to just make contact with the cushion. You just 1 second, literally just sit down. And then you're done for that day, but at least that way you don't lose sight of the commitment.
That's cool. I like that.
Yeah.
One of the things my teacher is Michael Taft, and he says when you don't want to practice, just sit there. Just literally, just go sit on the cushion and just sit there. And so that's like very effective, I think. And the other piece of advice I would give for both groups is to let yourself really enjoy the time that you're practicing. So this is, you know, we talked about jhanas last time, jhanas are bliss states. Mm-hmm. If you're only practicing for 3 minutes a day, you're not going to be doing jhanas. But what you can do is you can tune in to some part of your experience, whether it's like a body sensation or just notice that it feels nice to breathe or notice that there's some sounds going on around you that are pleasant to listen to and just kind of tune in to that pleasantness. Mm-hmm. And if your whole practice for a couple weeks is spending 3 minutes a day tuning into something pleasant, there's a way in which that kind of reinforces the motivation to practice, because then all the parts of you, even the like little tiny mammal parts, are learning that like, oh, this is fun. And I think a lot of times when we start out, particularly if we're practicing in more rigorous renunciate traditions where there's an idea that you have to sit for a long time or you have to give up worldly pleasures for enlightenment, we forget that practice can be fun and it can get to be kind of a slog or something that's like really unpleasant, but is being done for reward somewhere off in the future. And if the reward of practice is happening right now in the moment during the practice, it's going to be easier to maintain.
Yeah. You know, it's tricky because, like, I had never had anything like what you could call success meditating. I mean, nothing that made me want to keep doing it until I went to a retreat. And the first part of the retreat was very, very hard. And I was trying to focus on my breath, which is one thing they, which is almost the closest thing there is probably to a standard opening instruction, is to pay attention to your breath. And in the canon, in the Buddhist canon, like the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, the mindfulness text, I think they do start, he does start with breathing there. It's a common thing. And it was very hard because I felt the pressure to succeed in focusing on successive breaths, which I found very, very, very hard. And I kind of think like, and I noticed you didn't put it that way. You didn't put it like, stay focused on your breath. You said, just pay attention to things. It may be sounds. And I do think sound is underrated as an object of meditation, by the way. I like sound a lot. But so you didn't put it that way. I think it was kind of good that I wanted to master that and finally did at the retreat. But at the same time, if I was talking to somebody who's not at a retreat where they're not going to be like just forced to deal with it, I definitely wouldn't say, sit down and make sure you count X successive breaths. Yeah. And in fact, I might, you know, one thing that I say sometimes, this is very different from sitting down, but it's like, await a moment of opportunity. And for me, a good one, if you haven't meditated at all, is sadness. This may seem weird. You just sit down and close your eyes and observe what it feels like to be sad. That's something people don't normally do. Right.
Yes.
And but when you close your eyes, it's kind of an easy thing to do if you are feeling sad, because it is a very prominent feeling, but we spend most of our lives just reacting to feelings instead of observing them, which is a big part of the thing with meditation, is that if you shift more into observer mode, you're a lot better off. But that to me came very easily. Of course, you have to wait. You know, you can't like, I mean, step one, make yourself sad. You can't start that way, right? Like, you have to wait. But in a way, it's just what you're saying is sit down and observe whatever's going on in your sensory world or in your body or in your mind.
Yeah. And by picking something to observe that is inherently interesting, like you mentioned sadness, a lot of emotional experience is both inherently very interesting and something we, like you said, habitually turn away from. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good practice object, because you're not only retraining the mind to go towards something that it habitually avoids, but you've got an object there which is easy to stay with because it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. So part of choosing an object and using something that's enjoyable or at least fascinating is that there's this process of kind of falling in love with experience. And, you know, when you're falling in love, you don't have to think of, I got to remember to text that person who I'm falling in love with. You just remember naturally because there's this process of love that's happening. And I think we have overemphasized the breath as a meditation object, and we've overemphasized the importance of forcing the mind to stay on the breath.
Mm-hmm.
There's another way to do it where you find something to meditate on that is so interesting that the mind wants to stay with it. And there's this natural curiosity, and then there's kind of a relationship between the mind and the object, which is mutually reinforcing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very powerful way to practice. And it also feels effortless because the mind wants to do this. And it trains concentration, but in a way that doesn't feel like work. It feels like fun.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I will say that when I'm at a retreat, so the circumstances are conducive to getting really good at focusing on my breath, it becomes a pretty easy gateway to settling into a broader awareness. It's not like you do that for all 40 minutes of the sit. It's like you sit down and you do that, and then you're kind of focused, and then you can observe the various things going on very readily and constructively. I mean, I hope people understand that there's supposed to be benefits to establishing a different relationship to your thoughts and feelings than is normal for humans.
Yes. Yeah. And there's a reason that historically the breath is the object. You always have it with you. And most things that are going on emotionally are reflected in the breath. The respiration rate changes when you're having an emotional experience. It's really a very powerful window into experience. But for some people, the breath is a fraught object. And then the other larger issue is that we're bringing the kind of default mind into the practice. So the idea that concentration is difficult, there's a way to work really hard in order to be successful at this, and we have to just forcibly kind of block everything else out. And there's a way to use an object where we don't bring all of that baggage into the experience, and we just kind of find some joy and allow the joy to pull us into the practice.
So I've now lost track. Did you start off describing what you were describing about, like, just kind of pay attention? Was that for the novice meditator or for somebody who's trying to resume the practice or for both?
So I think the things that apply to both are start small and start with something that's inherently enjoyable to you. So one of the reasons a practice lapses is that you're just not enjoying it. You're doing it because you feel like you should. Or for several other reasons, it can lapse. And so bringing back the enjoyment of the practice, I think, is really important. There are some differences between people who are just starting out and people who, say, have a lot of momentum, which is the people who have a lot of practice momentum are probably going to up the dosage, like up the minutes they're doing per day at a faster rate than the beginners. I would say beginners should stay small until there's some kind of natural inclination to expand the amount of time that they're practicing. And the other thing that applies, I think, equally to both groups is to meditate with other people. So in the same way that having a group of people you exercise with or do anything else with, you don't have to supply all of that motivation yourself. If it's just the thing that you're doing, it's like, oh, every X night I go to this place and I meditate with other people. Then when you sit down, you don't have to use any kind of willpower to stay seated and doing the practice. The group kind of holds that for itself. And that can be a really powerful way to get back into a practice.
Okay. So how long have you been out in the Silicon Valley area?
Well, I lived in the South Bay in 2018. I lived in a house called the Consciousness Hacking House, and we were all working on different consciousness hacking projects. And then I went back east and I did my postdoc at Harvard. And then I came back out here in 2021 to start Lundic.
Well, elaborate on this consciousness hacking thing. So this was everything from psychedelics to meditation to both, or what?
We were very focused on using tech and applying technology to human flourishing. So the idea behind Consciousness Hacking, which was this like global organization that hosted monthly events and also had all sorts of people working on all kinds of projects in this domain. It was founded by someone named Mikey Siegel. And the idea was that we have there's a kind of inherently adversarial relationship between technology and spirituality and flourishing, but it doesn't have to be that way. It's just because we've been building tech that is kind of anti-flourishing and is all about kind of attentional capture and several other things that don't support people's highest selves, let's say. And the question was, well, what if we could create technologies that did support well-being, flourishing, spiritual development? So everyone in the house was working on some kind of project to that end. So Mikey was working on a thing called Group Flow, where you could plug 12 people in and you could visualize everyone's heart rate and respiration rate as sound and light. And in the center of the circle, there was like a light sound thing that aggregated everyone. So you could see the group, like physiology syncing up as people dropped in together. There were a bunch of other projects going on in the house that were all kind of along those lines.
So this was beyond mere meditation apps.
Yeah, the idea was to bring technology mm-hmm. into the spiritual development world and be able to, I don't want to use the word accelerate, but kind of, let's say, support spiritual development mm-hmm. with technology.
So I'm wondering if you've thought much about like AI and this stuff. I mean, there's two different angles I can think of. One of which is, and I was, as you know, I was actually out in your neck of the woods only a few days ago. And I saw a friend of yours who's involved in the AI community. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to him about this. And we were very much on the same wavelength on this one thing, which is that we both think that for humankind to handle AI wisely, we need to make some spiritual progress, at least to the point where we're not spending all our time having wars and being, you know, deeply divided geopolitically. So you have a Cold War, so you can't cooperate with, say, China on the challenge of handling the technology wisely. And this is somebody who knows a lot about AI, more than me. And so I was gratified to find that we're kind of on the same page. And that may sound a little kind of crazy and idealistic. You know, we need to grow spiritually. But we mainly just mean we need to stop having wars. And in order to do, and, you know, be in a geopolitical position to collaborate more internationally on policy generally, but especially this kind of policy. And we think, and by the way, this gets at the question of what enlightenment is. I don't want to let go of that. I want to get back to that. I mean, we both agree that one way to put it is we need, you know, our species needs to get at least a little closer to enlightenment. Because I think we both see enlightenment as something you can make incremental progress towards, not some state that suddenly descends on you out of nowhere. Although that can happen. People say, you know, they report these experiences, great, lucky you. You know, Eckhart Tolle is an example, probably sitting on a bench. It happens, hasn't happened to me, but the alternative is to make just incremental progress of the kind you actually feel, especially at a meditation retreat, I think, where you go, okay, at this point, I really am less self-absorbed than I am. I'm better at looking things from other people's points of view and not just looking them at them as objects who may threaten me in some way or who I may want to get to do something for me. And the same way with groups. I'm less engrossed in my own kind of tribal bias, whether it's a national group or a religious group or whatever, and I'm better able to look at the perspective of other people. I think a lot of people who have gone to meditation retreats would recognize what I'm talking about. We're not talking about something magical, really. We're talking about just an incremental progress that makes it easier for humans to get along with one another. So anyway, that's one angle, one kind of connection between AI and spiritual growth. The other is like using AI as a spiritual tool. Those are the two things I think of. I'm wondering if you've thought about either of those and which you're more eager to talk about.
Yeah, I think a lot about the people who are going to be using AI and people who are consumers. So kind of regular everyday people, not people who are big kind of geopolitical players, although that's very important too. But I think what's going to happen with AI getting better and better in the kind of attention economy we already have is that it is going to become just more and more important to have a little bit of distance and a little bit of freedom from your first thought or your first emotion. Already, entertainment is like too good. And there are people who spend all of their free time just consuming entertainment. And that's going to get better and better and better and more tailored to you personally. And harder to resist the pull of to leave your house and go into meet space and meet other people rather than be passively entertained by this almost like weapons grade entertainment that's going to be get better and better.
And are when you think of that, I mean, I think you're right. You know, first of all, social media optimized for engagement, and we saw what happened. It's very addictive, often in a not constructive way, I would say. AI, it's put out by companies. They're going to want to optimize for engagement. Naturally, they want to keep you using their product. And AI, and in fact, AI is behind the social media algorithms in a certain sense, but now we're moving into a kind of AI that is potentially much better at grabbing onto you and get you to look wherever it wants you to look and stay focused on whatever it wants you to stay focused on. And I'm wondering what kind of scenario you have in mind. You have in mind, well, okay, I've got a large language model that's my best friend and I trust it for guidance. Or do you imagine like entering the metaverse where you can construct your own dream thanks to AI? You know, this Sora video, you saw the Sora demonstration from.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not that far from putting on the virtual reality goggles and saying, here's the world I want to be in, right?
Yeah.
After which the world may take over because it wants to keep you there. What kind of scenario do you have in mind when you say, I take you to be saying you need to hang on to some of your autonomy or kind of.
Yes, exactly. And it's going to be more and more difficult to resist basically this kind of like highly, highly optimized bespoke entertainment that's going to be available and you could just spend all of your time consuming these things. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that meditation has done, at least for me personally, and kind of has a reputation for doing, is it allows you to see your thoughts and feelings as the analogy that often gets made is like clouds in the sky. So rather than be stuck in the cloud and believing that, I'm angry and I'm having these thoughts and these thoughts are true and I now must take action based on them. Mm-hmm. Instead of that kind of constricted default view, there's a way to have some space around that with larger and larger things and notice like, okay, I am angry. I'm having these thoughts. There's also a lot of other stuff going on in awareness. I can feel where in my body the anger is. And I know that these thoughts and feelings are temporary. And that doesn't mean you become like a useless puddle who never takes any action, but it means that you don't believe the stories that your thoughts are telling you or that the newspaper is telling you as much, and you have more space around it. And with that space, you have the freedom to choose how you're going to respond to a given input rather than kind of blindly reacting in ways that one often regrets later. So having just that little bit of space leads to a lot more freedom. And then there's even further it can go. One of the things that's interesting that happens with maybe high-dose retreat practice or, say, a lot of meditation experience aggregated over a lifetime.
High-dose retreat means frequent retreats or long retreats?
Yeah, I keep using the word high-dose. either frequent retreats or longer retreats.
Okay.
So I think 4 days is kind of the minimum amount of retreat practice to like that, really.
For me, that's barely enough, but.
Yeah.
Okay. But for someone going on
their. Yeah. Someone going on their first retreat, you know, my first retreat was 10 days and that was good. But mm-hmm. I've now sat with a lot of people whose first retreat was either 3 days non-residential or 4 days. And that's what those people needed to go on a retreat. Like they can't take 10 days mm-hmm. Or they're not sure enough because they haven't seen any benefit of practice yet that it's worth the time. And I think 3-4 days, like you could still get something useful out of. But one of the things that happens with a longer meditation practice, and you see this with some psychedelic practitioners too, is the practitioner gets better and better at holding, say, two conflicting truths at the same time without being overwhelmed by cognitive dissonance and thus needing to collapse into one truth or the other. So I was talking to someone once who had recently done mushrooms for the first time, and he was able to hold this polarity of his father had recently died and he had a very difficult relationship with his father. And he was able to hold simultaneously that he wished his father had treated him better and he was sad that his father was dead. Mm-hmm. And he had never been able to occupy both of those realities at once. He had been kind of toggling back and forth between those two extremes. And being able to see them both at once and realize, oh, both of these things are true, increased the freedom he felt and the kind of like peace he had around that situation. And this is something that happens with a longer meditation practice. And you see this in Mahayana Buddhism, right? In the second turning of Buddhism, you get these works that are like form and emptiness are the same thing. Nirvana and samsara are the same thing. And they're just going through and busting these polarities. Mm-hmm. And that level of practice, I think, is going to become really powerful going forward, with people not feeling like they need to occupy one truth at the expense of the opposite of the polarity, but instead be able to see the wisdom in both sides of a seemingly binary situation.
Mm-hmm. And there's something a little related that I think seems less ambitious and so maybe easier for people to relate to if they haven't had profound meditative experience, but just to recognize the reality of multiple points of view.
Yeah.
It's just a reality that from my perspective, this looked like this. And from the other person's perspective, it looked like that. And those are two things that are, to the extent that you can call either of the perspectives true, they're equally true from the kind of vantage point you can get closer to by meditating.
There's something in Buddhism where you talk about causes and conditions, and mm-hmm. the causes and conditions of the world determine outcomes. And there's a really powerful thing to understand, which is when you're looking at another person who has a different point of view, you kind of deepen into this perspective of like, oh, if my life had had the causes and conditions of their life, by definition, I would be holding this view.
Taking this seriously.
Yes.
Would be a wonderful thing for everyone in the world to do. Yes. I just said, just the other day, I used the phrase, there but for the grace of God go I. And that's what I mean by it. Yes. And we will get back to AI, I swear. And maybe we're headed that way because I'm about to bring up Western science, but the Buddhist emphasis, the Buddhist recognition of how precisely formative your conditions are, mm-hmm. it's just a way of taking causality seriously. You know, the mm-hmm. idea, I mean, it's a very, you would think of it as a very Western scientific view to say, well, you're a product of your genes and your environment, and that's it. Of course, there's a whole argument about free will, but kind of the default Western science position is like, those are the only forces we know of, genes and environment, and they turn a person into the person they are. And that's what we mean when we say, if you recognize that, you may be more forgiving of people and more understanding of them. But Buddhism, without using, genes, environment, you know, Buddhism is very much in that mode in a way that, you know, and was like thousands of years ago in a way that I think Western religious and maybe even philosophical traditions were not quite so much, but it's a very big part of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the idea of dependent origination, which is like a very complex philosophical system. But basically, the central tenet of it is that for something to exist, everything else has to exist. There is no independent inherent existence that anything has.
Right.
So if I kind of walk into a room and there's a piece of chocolate cake there, and I want the cake, there's a version of Katie who wants that cake, and it arose, that self arose because that cake is uh-huh. there, and they can't exist without one another. And this idea that there are selves that arise in a moment, in not just in response to, but almost co-created with what is happening in the environment in that moment, I think leads to a level of humility there where mm-hmm. you just have to understand, oh, if I had had the life experience of this other person, I would be holding that view. So there's mm-hmm. this view of the self as a process with no inherent stable existence, and this kind of humility that comes from knowing that you're doing the best you can with the information that you have available to you, and so is everyone else.
Yeah. And I do think a meditative practice can make it easier to see that, because it's one thing to say it. I just said it. And yet the next time somebody pisses me off, I'm going to lose sight of it. I'm going to want them to suffer. Right? They deserve to be punished. Back to AI, I probably derailed a train of thought of yours. We were talking about AI. Did you want to say more than we said?
So I think there are a couple things to think about. I think there are the people who are actually building the AI, And what kind of causes and conditions have they been subject to? What are they optimizing for? And what's the place from which they're building? You know, we create the tools that we can conceive of, and the level of, just to sound like a hippie for a moment, like the level of consciousness that's creating those tools is going to be the level of consciousness reflected in the tools. And I'm using consciousness there to mean just like a well-being and awareness, not not going to talk about AGI or sentience. But the thing I think about more is the just the regular people who are trying to just live a good life and don't necessarily have the capacity to resist these things, you know, like as deep fakes become more common and as better entertainment starts to exist, and as we stop knowing what is real, like what's a real video and what's a faked one, all of these things, the people who are consuming the output of these tools, I think it's going to be very important on both sides for the level of introspection to go up and the level of sort of discernment and ability to respond in a way that has kind of freedom and clarity in it. Or else, I mean, a lot of these tools are just too powerful for the human mind was not designed. doesn't have the tools necessarily to cope with these things.
No. And these things will get better and better at exploiting in a certain sense, the tools the human mind does have. It's funny. I just today, I think I was reading about how a number of states are outlawing like deep fakes or maybe deep fakes involving nudity, various things. And I thought, I guess that's good, but I was wondering, you know, it might be better if the stuff was so unregulated that everyone cultivated the habit of just profound skepticism. I mean, I don't know, you know, like just taking it all less seriously. And not, I mean, I assume that could lead to a certain kind of disorientation and alienation and nihilism and craziness in its own right. But I in any event, think that a certain kind of skepticism is going to be a healthy thing to carry.
Yeah, I think some basic sort of literacy. People talk about this with science journalism a lot, is people who read science journalism don't necessarily know statistics. Or when you look at an fMRI scan, you know, there was this study that showed that a scientific, like a pop science article was much more likely to be rated as true by readers if it had a picture of a brain in it. Didn't matter. So there's this sort of like scientific literacy that's not super high. And I think we're going to need some AI literacy or some like deep fake literacy. But more important than that, I think, is this introspective ability. So, you know, there are times where probably a given person wants to like eat a lot of ice cream and watch three movies in a row. And you do that. And then at the end of that, you do not feel good. And being able to actually feel that and connect up that the impulse with how it actually feels, rather than just kind of feel the impulses and act on them, being able to maintain awareness through that whole arc from stimulus to first response to, okay, how does this feel now, like 5 minutes later and then 10 minutes later? Having a continuous awareness through that whole process is the kind of thing that can break addictive loops and can kind of pull you out of this never-ending, like attention-grabbing, entertaining machine.
Yeah, the addictive loops thing is interesting because, I mean, on the one hand, there is, you know, or documented successes using meditation to overcome the standard kind of chemical addictions, and for that matter, using psychedelics in some cases to overcome them. But then there's also the fact that so many of problems of life are addictions, even though they're not, you don't think of them as chemical addictions. I mean, chemistry is involved in mediating any addiction, but they're not addictions to a chemical, but they are addictions. I mean, it's just, when you really start paying attention to your own behavior, like online, you just realize, you know, how many like, oh, this is my go-to thing when I'm stuck on an email. I just click on Twitter without even thinking about it, you know? And it's like, and resisting that hurts because there's a, like a yearning to do that in my, you know?
And a lot of it also is avoidance. So
I'm avoiding the email. It's the aversion and attraction, like both are involved in getting you from this thing that maybe you should be doing to this thing that maybe you shouldn't be doing.
Yeah. And this is where the move you mentioned earlier about meditating on strong emotions like sadness or anger and really getting into like turning towards and seeing what's going on there. That kind of practice on the cushion will translate out to like clicking over to Twitter while you're supposed to be writing an email. So this practice of like knowing how you are actually feeling at any given moment rather than reflexively avoiding things that are unpleasant ends up translating out into all sorts of other things for the better.
Yeah. So we've been talking a while. We are about to go into overtime, which is something that's available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. I don't want to go there quite yet. I want to give you time to kind of wrap up, say anything you want to add. I mean, once we go there, I do want to talk about a few things. I do want to get into enlightenment a little more and how to reconcile thinking of it as this ultimately very powerful thing with thinking of it as something that you can make incremental progress towards. I have a way of thinking about that. Maybe talk more about AI. And then I want to confess to you my this pathetic thing I did to help get my practice back on track. I would never confess that publicly. People have to pay to hear this. And also a psychedelic thing that I want to mention. And then who knows where we'll go.
Great.
But so anyway. You can there's in your podcast app, there's a thing you can click to subscribe to the newsletter, and you can Google the Non-Zero newsletter, and then once you're a paid subscriber, you can set up a podcast feed that'll just make it automatic that you always see the overtime segments. But first, what else would you like to say to the entire audience? I mean, first of all, your thing is called the Alembic, Alembic, in Berkeley. If you don't live in Berkeley, you can still check it out online. What else do you have to say? Not just by way of self-promotion, although I encourage that, or not self-promotion, as we say in Buddhism.
Non-self-promotion.
But by way of elaborating on anything you've said or any closing messages or thoughts or anything.
Yeah. I mean, I think going back to our discussion about the beginners versus experienced meditators and like what really helps with a practice. And I'm not just saying this because Alembic is there. I created Alembic partially because I believe this very strongly. There's something very powerful about practicing meditation with other people. And in my own life, I meditated alone for 15 years. And I didn't start meditating with other people until just a few years ago. And the difference it made in my practice was indescribable. I mean, exponentially better when I had other people not only to sit with, but also to talk with about what was going on in practice. So I strongly recommend if you're wanting to meditate, to find an actual space. Don't just use an app. Find an actual space you can go. If you're in the Bay, come to the Alembic. If you're somewhere else, find another place or find a place online and meet other practitioners and talk to them. And tying that to the discussion of AI, I think going forward, it's going to become more and more important to have real life meet space relationships with real people and non-digitally mediated conversations. And so my advice would be to build those now before they become super, super rare.
Right. I mean, we hope that when they become super rare, there will be virtual versions that work pretty well, but I'm not sure there are as many of those as we'd like right now. So, thanks. And thanks to everybody who has stayed with us, whether or not you're staying with us in overtime, and we'll see you next time.